Sky News Centre at 6. A woman has described in detail how she allegedly had sex with Prince Andrew in 2001 when she was 17. Virginia Roberts Dufresne had previously claimed in court documents that she slept with the Duke at her friend Ghislaine Maxwell's home. She's now spoken about the allegations to the American broadcaster NBC.
I was so young. Ghislaine woke me up in the morning and said, "You're going to meet a prince today." I didn't know at that point that I was going to be trafficked to that prince. And then that night, Prince Andrew came to her house in London and we went out.
Buckingham Palace has always said it emphatically denies the allegations. The Brexit secretary has met EU chief negotiator Michel Barnier. Stephen Barclay says they have a common purpose and talks will continue next week. Millions of people across the world are taking part in climate protests. Demonstrators are calling for governments to take action on rising global temperatures. The boyfriend of a teenager killed in a park in East London has given an emotional account of how she collapsed in his arms. 17-year-old Jodie Chesney was with friends when she was stabbed in Harold Hill in March. Eddie Coyle, who's 18, has been giving evidence at the Old Bailey, where four people deny her murder. Our reporter Ali Fortescue has been listening.
He said that she was in shock, screaming loudly and continuously for 3 minutes straight. He went on to say that she was wearing a thick jacket, so he didn't know how bad the wound was at first, but there was a lot of blood. And he said that Jodie then fainted and collapsed in his arms.
Ryanair pilots based in the UK have called off 5 days of strike action, which were due to start tomorrow. The airline and unions have said they'll resume talks next week. And Celtic have been fined £11,000 by UEFA over the behaviour of their fans in their Europa League playoff with AIK. They were charged with setting off flares and throwing objects during the match last month. That's the latest. I'm Anna Bates.
You've contributed in excess of £13,000 to help us rebuild our studios and station facilities. Our volunteers, trustees and management are eternally grateful for your continued support and we'll bring you all a fully restored service very soon.
BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's politics show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. Labour councillor for Bedminster, Celia Phipps. Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is here too. Okay, so after the 7 o'clock news, Abqaiq and Quraysh. Two Saudi oil terminals destroyed last weekend, supposedly by the Houthi rebels in Yemen. Saudi Arabia happens to be massacring. But they and the Americans say it's actually the Iranians behind it. Iran threatens all-out war if it's attacked as a supposed retaliation, and all is quiet for the time being. But half Saudi Arabia's oil supplies have been cut. How long will this take to repair? Might we have to start buying oil, perish the thought, from Venezuela and even from Iran? Would the West stomach that? Also, our Super Brains series continues this week with financial wizard you'll never hear on the mass media, at least not more than a tiny soundbite. He used to work for Oxfam and then he got a job inside the system so he could trace the roots of financial crimes, which brought him, guess where? Guess where, Martin? To the City of London. And a million tons of radioactive water is about to be dumped into the Pacific Ocean on the same week as all TEPCO executives were found not guilty of ignoring safety advice, despite it having been proved in court that they did ignore it. So can the Pacific cope with this massive injection of lethal poison? How come so little protest from the environmental movement? Are Japanese courts as independent as those British courts? Or are they controlled too? That's all in the second hour after the US-owned Comcast News at 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So So tonight, lows of 11 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs around 24 Celsius, sunny tomorrow. But, as we just heard on the previous show, thundery showers on Sunday. Watch out for them. And if you want to go and enjoy the weather, make sure you do it tomorrow. Forget the big weekly shop, eh? Next week, highs around 18 Celsius, plenty of showers though through the week, summer heavy, and also in between those sunny spells. Next weekend is the 28th and 29th of September, highs still reasonable, around 17 Celsius, mainly cloudy though, again though, next weekend with some showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from the Weather Outlook. Now, notable by their absence on this show, and I'll be reminding listeners of this in the run-up to supposed Brexit on the 31st of October, are all Bristol's senior politicians. Not one of Bristol's six MPs, the four Labour and two Conservative, as well as two of our three mayors, that's Labour Mayor Marvin Rees and Tory Metro Mayor Tim Bowles, all of them have refused failed to reply to requests. Both those two flat down refused. Only our Lord Mayor, Joss Clark, who chairs Bristol's full council meetings, put in an appearance here. She's happy to talk. So despite those refusals, I've kept asking each week, and after a month or so of requests, now have clear rejections in from Labour's Bristol East, Kerry McCarthy, Bristol West, Thangam Debonair, also from South, Karen Smith, and former Universities Ministers and Tory Kingswood MP Chris Skidmore. Only Labour MP Darren Jones from North West, as well as Filton Tory MP and Bradley Stoke Tory MP Jack Napresti, they're the only two who've actually still failed to reply with any kind of clear idea. So not one of those eight of our top politicians want to answer questions about Brexit. One would have thought this would be a perfect place for them to do so, but maybe they might face some hostile questions from Martin or I. But, you know, why do our MPs not want to say anything? Can I just ask you straight away, Joss, what you make of that? I mean, the MPs, surely they're there to serve us, but they don't want to come and answer questions about Brexit. Why might that be?
Did you mean me?
Sorry, Celia.
Well, I think they are talking online and in letters, and you know, it's a topic that's talked about over and over again with constituents, especially on the doorstep. And probably talking on the doorstep is one of the best places to have those conversations.
Martin, what about the mayors, for example? No, I mean, we've got three mayors. We've got a Lord Mayor, we've got a Metro Mayor, and we've got a Mayor. And it's only Joss Clark from the Lib Dems, the Lord Mayor, that will come and speak.
Well, I mean, you'd have to ask those people concerned why they don't want to come on this particular show or don't want to, you know, talk about Brexit in general. I can't really speak for any of them. You'll understand that these are busy people and they've got their own priorities as they see it. And of course, one of their priorities may be to avoid awkward questions.
Well, we've had them on in the past. This is the point.
Yeah.
They come on, you know, every once in a while. All of them have been on, apart from Chris Skidmore. Mm. There doesn't seem to be any particular reason why they wouldn't, other than, like you say, hostile questions. Anyway, this week we've had, the Lib Dem conference, and the conference season has just about started. And actually, isn't it normal for Parliament not to be sitting during the conference, Celia, season?
Yes, it is, because obviously people want to go to their individual conferences. But this is a very strange time to have a closed Parliament when you actually want to have conversations. Who knows what Mr. Johnson is discussing, and who knows who he's talking to when he gets back to the UK? We will wait and see.
Well, what do you make of the whole, for you, what's Brexit about? What would you like to see happen, and how do you think it's been dealt with?
I think that's the sort of million-dollar question, isn't it? Absolutely. I don't want to leave the EU at all. That's my stance. But if we do have to go, I think we have to leave with a deal. So let's hope it's a decent one. And let's hope that we can still have at least friendly and good relationship with our European friends and neighbours. I mean, we need them, they need us.
Well, I mean, actually leaving the EU doesn't mean to say we can't have friendly relations with them, does it?
No, it doesn't, but trade agreements are, you know, are legal documents written that mean that we have different relationships by default, which is a huge shame in my view.
Martin?
Well, I mean, obviously this is the most serious constitutional crisis in the country since World War II. And, of course, it's got all sorts of implications, which we've discussed week by week.
Actually, joining the EU was a bit of a crisis, wasn't it? Because it was joined without a referendum, and then there was a whole debacle about whether or not we should have a referendum back in the 1970s.
Yeah, all right. But, I mean, the point is that leaving Brexit aside, I mean, the Supreme Court, as we speak, is discussing this, and Lady Hale has made it clear. We're not discussing the rights and wrongs of Brexit. We're talking about the rights and wrongs of proroguing Parliament. Parliament hasn't been prorogued like this in a confrontational way, certainly since World War II and going back into the 18th and 17th centuries.
Well, some have said since the 1970s. But anyway, what do you make of this Supreme Court? I mean, is the Supreme Court independent? I mean, for example, in the United States, it seems like a system which has been brought over from the US. Up until 10 years ago, we didn't have a Supreme Court. And one does wonder about the judiciary and how independent they really are.
Well, we didn't have a Supreme Court because it was just decided by the House of Lords. That was our equivalent, that was our alternative. The House of Lords, of course, which was previously non-elected. So we've got a pretty dog's breakfast of a constitution, and now we're testing that dog's breakfast to the limit. But we shall see what comes out of all of this. And, you know, the political implications of it are there, but the legal implications are also there, because we've signed up to, we've signed up to various European conventions on how to conduct things, which are still legally binding. And we've also got our own case law going back to the 17th century. So, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out.
So it does seem to have been strung out a little bit, this decision. I was hoping that we'd have a Supreme Court say X, Y, whatever, like the other courts, the lower courts did. But no, it's Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Oh, we're going to have a long weekend. And maybe we'll tell you next Tuesday. So it's a week of decision making. It does make you wonder, and especially if anyone has seen those big piles of legal papers that they're taking in on trolleys. Is this going to be an independent decision, or is someone just simply going to be telling the Supreme Court, these judges, well, this is the way we want it to come out?
I honestly don't know the answer to that question, because I imagine as lawyers they're looking through all the legal what you can and what you can't do, and that will guide some of their judgment. They'll look back at the past, at legal decisions, which we've never had to make a decision on this kind of issue in the modern world like this before. So I don't envy them. Their job, quite frankly.
Well, we shall see what happens. Don't forget, it was because Gina Miller took the government to court. Theresa May was attempting to do a Brexit without discussion with Parliament at all. She said, we're just going to deal with the EU, we're going to do a deal, and that's what's going to happen. And Gina Miller said, no, you've got to put it through Parliament. And basically, the courts agreed that she had to go back to Parliament because that's the British Constitution. And don't forget, the Tories tried to do it without Parliament. Well, they failed because they can't do it like that, and I think they're probably going to fail in this case.
One of the
well.
Most interesting things I heard that the courts had been saying this week, Supreme Court has been saying this week, was that there's just no legislation around this, Celia. That there's never been a law that says when Parliament should and shouldn't be prorogued. So one does wonder why the courts are getting involved at all if there's no apparent law on this.
Well, that's a very interesting one, then, isn't it? If they're, you know. Are they having to make it up as they go along based on seemingly similar incidents, impossible?
Isn't this what they call common law, where it's just made up by the courts? And you know, where there isn't a law, the courts can decide.
Well, it is, but you've got a legal system in Scotland which is different from the legal system in England. And as you can see, the Scottish legal system has concluded that the advice given to the Queen by Johnson was illegal. I would also point out that with a minority government, they've got minus 41 in terms of the government supporting the Commons, and therefore he's not even necessarily the Prime Minister, so he can't have a Queen's speech anyway. So maybe this whole thing would be want to have a Queen's speech.
No, hang on.
No, he's elected by the head of the Conservative Party, but he's never won a vote in Parliament.
He is the Prime Minister, but he's the Prime Minister stuck in power.
No, can I just make this point, Tony? It's a very important point. Going back to the 18th century, for somebody to be the Prime Minister in this country, you've got to have a vote in the House of Commons which consolidates your position. He's won a vote in the Conservative Party, but he hasn't got a majority in the House
Actually,
of Commons,
that's
quite
not,
clearly.
Martin, that's not what makes a Prime Minister.
No, it's going back to the 18th
just
century.
Just a minute, you've just had your say. Can you
legal
stop?
Position.
Martin, you've just had your say. I'm going to say mine. And one thing you can always do is just talk over the other person if you don't want to hear what they've got to say. But what I'm going to say is the reason that he's the Prime Minister is because he was the head of the largest party at the time, and at the point when he was made Prime Minister, although he's had defections since, he's still Prime Minister for the time being until we have a vote of confidence.
That's only because of the Fixed-Term Parliament Act. The precedent going back to the 18th century is you've got to win a vote. If you lose a vote, it could be argued that he's not legitimately the Prime Minister and therefore not in a position to make a
Prime
Minister.
Well, it could be argued, but I mean...
It could be argued, and it will be argued. It's being argued in the Supreme Court as we speak.
Let's not state this as fact on here, definitely, because at the moment he is the Prime Minister. So it's the silly season. I call it the silly season. Actually, officially in the mass media, the silly season is the month of August, when there's all sorts of funny news turns up, which isn't political news, but when I call it, it's the conference season, where we've got the Lib Dems. This week, it's been up until Tuesday at Bournemouth. Starting tomorrow until next Wednesday, it's the Labour Party meeting in Brighton. So we've got the Conservatives after that. From Sunday the 29th of September to Wednesday the 2nd of October in Manchester, and the Green Party and Plaid Cymru have the same Friday the 4th till Sunday the 6th of October. Green Party are in Cardiff, Plaid Cymru in Swansea, and then the SNP finally there from Sunday the 13th to Tuesday the 15th of October in Aberdeen. Celia, will you be going to the Labour conference this time?
No.
Have you been before, Matt?
Not this time, and I haven't actually. I've been to local government association conferences, which are very good, but not the big one as it is.
Because, I mean, isn't that where decisions... Actually, the Labour Party seems to me, I may be wrong, Martin, but the Labour Party is one of the main parties that actually makes decisions at its conferences on policy. Now, this is quite important, isn't it, if you want to live in a democracy, that the party actually gets its members together and they say, well, we're going to do this, and then they take that on as a national policy. It's very easy for people who are full-time officials in a party or else full-time politicians in Westminster to say, well, actually, we're going to do what we want. We don't have to do what the members say.
Oh, well, absolutely, and that's why, you know, we choose members that want to be part of that process to go. I mean, I actually feel that at the level I'm working, I'm almost too busy to leave the day job, as it were. But there are people who we work in our branches with people, so we'll have discussions where we'll take motions to that. The motions then go up the chain, and then make their way to conference. So that, I think that's a good thing. And yeah, there's been some quite challenging motions raised, and that's the right place to do it. There's certainly an opportunity to talk, to chat, to mix, to network. Great places.
Okay, so there's been some news this week in the Morning Star. Labour's Bristol North West MP accused of spying on local members in re-selection row. Now, this is just the Morning Star, the left-wing press, and it starts off by saying Blairite MP, remember this is the Morning Star, not the Daily Mirror or the Bristol Post, Blairite MP Darren Jones has been accused of spying and using legal intimidation against local members in his re-selection protest, the Star has learned. Local Labour sources say the Bristol North West MP asked members to attend a trigger ballot meeting in order to record what was said so he can pass the details to a law firm. Documents seen by the Star show Mr. Jones sent an email to his constituency's executive committee which said, I will have at least two volunteers at each meeting, one of whom will be there to note procedure and compliance. For your information, I have now instructed a law firm to work with those compliance volunteers should any issues arise. Now, this does sound, Martin, like the heavies coming in, really. Rather than allowing people to just think and say what they want, everything that's said at these local reselection meetings is going to be recorded, and the local MP has decided he's going to get lawyers to look at everything that's said. Now, this doesn't sound like it's a kind of free and fair process to see whether he's going to be reselected or not.
Well, you'd have to ask his opinion of all this. I don't know enough.
Well, he won't come on to this show to give his opinion.
Darren's the one he has been on the show not that long ago.
Yeah, but not at the moment, so I can't ask him that.
I'm just saying, it's no point me trying to justify what
anyway, he's
doing
regarded as being on the party's
right. I don't
right,
know enough about it.
Being a supporter of Labour Friends of Israel, having previously worked on US Democrat Hillary Clinton's presidential nomination campaign.
So in other words, he feels threatened by some of the views of his own party members, and they obviously are not necessarily in tune with his views. I mean, this is the bread and butter of political arguments, and of course legal arguments sometimes come into it. It's generally a reflection of people's relationships breaking down when they call the lawyers in, isn't it?
Bristol's Momentum spokesman Karen Glassmith told the Star, "It's really disappointing to see this lack of trust for our MP, who we all campaigned for. He's taking time and money which could have been spent on campaigning and using it to hire law firms and spy on his members." Celia, sounds potentially quite serious. Have you got similar things going on in Bristol South, do you know? Because the Labour Party is going through this process at the moment, isn't it, to potentially reselect its MPs. So it looks to me as if Darren is trying to make sure that everybody is being monitored as this is happening.
Well, I know nothing about what's happening in that part of Bristol. I mean, the selection process, if you've got an MP that you think isn't doing your job, and I think Karen Smith is doing a fantastic job in South Bristol, so at the time when we've got lots of things to think about, having a selection process to me seems like a waste of good time on the doorstep, quite honestly. If there was an absolute two people who you clearly thought could be as good as each other, then that might be a different thing. But I think at this point in time, when we've got a very imminent election, we don't know when the date is, but it could be any time, I think this process is difficult.
Well, he may be getting local members' backs up by doing this sort of thing, and it's interesting that it's been covered by the Morning Star. Anyway, we'll see what happens, whether there are trigger ballots. There wasn't a trigger ballot for the mayor, so Marvin Rees will be the Labour candidate for mayor again this year. Mm-hmm. And one does wonder if some of the Labour Party officials are involved in trying to make sure that there's as little time and effort spent on this as possible and people get automatically reselected. But anyhow, I'm also joined by who's just turned up, which is not very good for a naval reserve to turn up late, because you don't want to be turning up late to the war, do you? By David Banks from Veterans for Britain. Hi, David. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Can you just tell us a little bit about Veterans for Britain, who they are, who you are?
Yes. We started off in the referendum as a leave campaign. Made up of members of the armed forces, ex-members of the armed forces. It's important to say ex because it is only really retired people who have moved on from the forces life who are able to go into politics. We realised early on that quite a high percentage of people who had served in the armed forces were interested in a leave vote. And I think it's probably something to do with the fact that having put your life on the line for the country, the whole perception of the nation and integrity of the nation is a bit more keener in those people's
minds. But hang
mind.
On, because I mean, all the big conflicts like Iraq, Afghanistan, these sorts of things, Europe has been as one. I mean, it's not just for Britain that people have been fighting over there, is it?
Europe has won.
Europe has been as one, almost. I mean, not every country, but, for example, we've had most of the NATO countries involved in Afghanistan, in Iraq.
I don't quite recognise what you're saying.
Well, I'm saying that you're not necessarily fighting for your country. Yeah, you know, in a way, you've been fighting. You know, people have been fighting for Europe, haven't they?
No, I don't think so. I mean, people might put that idea forward, but the decisions that have been made have been done in the interests of the country, albeit that sometimes, you know, in the case of Blair, there was an alternative agenda, and you know, the wisdom of certain deployments might be questioned. But they were political decisions, with the blame resting on the politicians. But I don't think we've ever sort of been into conflict.
Tell us a bit about yourself. What does it involve being a naval reserve? Do you have to sort of spend a weekend on a ship or something?
Yeah, I'm not here to discuss that, and I'm actually not allowed to mix politics and my naval reserve duties.
Okay. What about your journalistic work, though, that you've done in the past?
I've worked in the Middle East. I've worked for a regional newspaper. Done a bit of journalism before.
So which regional newspaper?
The News in Portsmouth, where I come from.
Oh, right, okay. So, yeah, and Portsmouth is quite a big centre, isn't it, for all of this. Your take, then, on this development with Brexit this week, where we're having the Supreme Court looking at it. We've just been chatting about it. I just wonder what your take is and what you think the result's going to be, if you've got a crystal ball next week.
I haven't taken a lot of notice, to be honest. I think it's a big distraction. What politicians and Westminster and the Supreme Court should be doing is considering the way that we voted in 2016 and just get on with it. There are a lot of people who are getting very cheesed off with a few tiny number of people with a lot of money who are in a position to bring court cases, and completely spurious. And you know, let's get on with the democratic process. We've got a government that wants to carry out the democratic instruction 3 years ago, more than 3 years ago. When is the government going to enact that decision? We're supposed to be a democracy. And so if they're going to be messing about, I don't care how they mess about, but they just need to stop. So I'm taking no notice at all of that Supreme Court case, because I've got better things to do. Because whilst all that nonsense is going on, we've got ministers who've been putting us further into the defence arrangements that are being created by the EU. And you know what? All of this stuff about Supreme Court, Gina Miller, you know, parliamentary shenanigans, this is a massive distraction, because it's far more convenient for them to talk about things like that than to talk about the actual stuff that's going on.
Well, okay, tell us then, in what way it might a deal, I suppose if it's a no deal, then there won't be any. But, I mean, will a deal include defence arrangements between the different countries?
If there's any deal, it'll be on EU terms. The EU won't accept a deal that's unpalatable to them or is inconvenient to them. And the only deal that's being proposed at the moment is one that has defence and security front and centre of the whole document.
In what way? So in what way will it bind, if there's a deal, the British military?
Well, you'd have to go through the structures we'd be a part of in order to start describing that. And they've made it intentionally very complicated, because the way that it was designed in the first place was with the UK as a member, and with a plan to put it past the UK public without the UK really noticing, and for UK ministers to be able to sign it off without it being described as an EU army and all things like this, which we avoid saying. It's just not a phrase we use. It's a far more subtle attachment than that. So there are three principal structures mentioned in the political declaration, which are the European Defence Fund, Permanent Structured Cooperation, and European Defence Agency. These three structures are three of the principal pillars of what the EU now calls the European Defence Union. Other ones are the Coordinated Annual Review on Defence, CSDP, the MPCC, which is the EU's military HQ. Most of these things that I've just named are completely new since the referendum. After we voted to leave, the EU went absolutely hell for leather trying to get this stuff locked in. And while UK ministers were giving their consent to these things being locked in, we, the British public, were treated like mugs and told that all of these, all the The green light that the British ministers were giving to these structures was because we were leaving. And that changed within about a year and a half, and the UK government under May produced a document that said, actually, you know what, we're staying in all these things. But because you haven't noticed us joining them in the first place, we're not going to talk much about it. So these three structures that I mentioned, European Defence Agency, European Defence Fund, and Permanent Structured Cooperation, are conveniently mentioned in isolation, even though they don't exist in isolation in the EU rule books. Every one of those three has accompanying rules, obligations, and structures, and being a part of one requires participants to be in the whole of the EU defence rule book, which is called CSDP.
It's all very well, but how would this actually affect, if at all, individual soldiers, you know, young Bristolians going out to fight somewhere? You know, because most of what we've been doing is been in conjunction with our European friends anyway.
Well, no, it hasn't, quite honestly, because, you know, when we have any trouble, it tends to be America, principally, who comes to our aid, such as in the Gulf recently. And our principal alliance is NATO, which is North Atlantic, including North America and parts of Europe, not all of the EU. And we have other defence relationships around the world, including with you know, Commonwealth countries, Australia, even you know, Chile, and Japan. Now, the point about why it's a bad thing is partly because of the way that these structures might treat the soldier on the ground, whether on, you know, on deployment. But the biggest travesty of all these things actually is the way that our votes and our integrity as a nation and our defence sovereignty, which are supposed to be sacred things, have just been completely ripped up and trodden over.
Well, fascinating, but there's been quite a lot going on this week. I think we may start by having a listen to the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, because there's been a lot of people questioning him about exactly what his position is, whether the Labour Party is going to wants to leave with a deal or whether it wants to remain. What's your understanding, Celia?
The Labour Party would prefer, I think, certainly Labour members, I think, in the majority, would prefer to remain. It's the leadership of the Labour Party has a slightly different view, in my view. But if we do have to leave, then we'll leave with a deal. But I think the other offer was to put back an offer to have a second referendum, so that we can relook at the decision, which I think is, many people I speak to have changed their minds. They feel that they didn't have the information they needed for the first referendum, and now they've got a different set of information. There will always be people who have differing views, and I think it's very, very clear that this whole topic has polarised many people.
Well, what do you say to voters who say to you, well, this is the first time I've voted for many, many years, because this is, I think, one of the biggest and the most important decisions, and now you're just ignoring what I've said? As many Leave people have said, that if this decision is ignored, then they will never vote again.
Well, I think that's a decision that often happens. If you're talking to people on the doorstep, you will have differing views, and people who have perhaps voted in the past or haven't voted before and vote. I mean, we want people to vote. I think that's a message that we will.
But this is the referendum was one of the biggest votes for 20 years, more turnout for 20 years, and now we're saying, oh well, actually, we're going to not do what you said. Anyway, let's have a listen to Jeremy Corbyn's answer, because this is quite a conundrum, isn't it, for him? He's got a big part of his party that wants him to remain and another big part that wants him to get a deal.
We will present an offer to the British people which will be remain in the EU as it is, hopefully with some reforms in the future, but also leave but maintaining a trade relationship, a customs union, obviously maintaining the open border between Northern Ireland and the Republic, and dynamic relationship on consumer rights, environmental protections, and rights at work. I think that's a good offer to put to the British people. And that is something they're not getting at the moment.
I totally understand that, but what I'm trying to understand as a voter, as a member of the public, is what do you believe? What do you want? Do you want to leave with a negotiated exit that you negotiate that protects jobs? Or do you actually believe that we should remain in the EU?
The bottom line is protecting jobs and living standards and a trade relationship with Europe. That is my bottom line. The offer is either you continue within the European Union, and there are obviously many people are very upset with the European Union, look at the referendum result, or we have the deal that we can achieve with the European
and
Union.
I
think that is a sensible position for
a
political party.
As a leader, what do you believe? What do you want?
The best for the British people and the best arrangements we can get so that we maintain our trade relationships and our living standards, but above all, that we bring people and communities and the country together. We're riven with the most horrible divisions because of the behaviour, partly of our government and others, over this. We have to bring people together, and I think our offer can do that.
Yeah, I think Corbyn's position has been pretty clear all along. He's in favour of a soft Brexit.
But he's not being clear there, is he? He's been asked, what do you want? But he won't answer.
What he's said, and he said it over the last 2 days, Tony, is that he will be neutral in any referendum and he will allow Labour Party members to campaign on either side.
That's not leadership, is it?
No, it is leadership in the situation that we're in. I think it's a perfectly rational position. He's saying, I will negotiate a deal, which will be, and he's already been talking to the EU about what the deal will involve. It'll be a Norway-style deal, so we'll stay inside the single market, which is what Nigel Farage, when we had the referendum, said. Anybody says we're leaving the single market is scaremongering. So we didn't talk, the single market wasn't on the ballot.
Norway's
had two referendums to join the EU. Both times they've refused to join the EU.
Okay.
From their point of view, it's too right.
We're going to hear now from Jean-Claude Juncker, who says the backstop is not really necessary any longer.
I had a meeting with Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister. This was a rather positive meeting, although the British press was reporting it in the other way. We can have a deal. I'm doing everything to have a deal because I don't like the idea of a no deal, because this would have catastrophic consequences. It's better, and for Britain and for the European Union, as far as the so-called alternative arrangements are concerned, allowing us and Britain to achieve the main objectives of the backstop. I don't have an erotic relation to the backstop, but if the results are there, I don't care about the instrument. If the objectives are met, all of them, then we don't need the backstop, but because anyway, backstop was a guarantee instrument and not an instrument, a name by itself.
And do you think that there is a chance that Brexit might not happen?
That's not my scenario. I'm convinced that Brexit will happen.
You think it's going to happen?
I think so.
Well, that's the former Luxembourg politician Jean-Claude Juncker. He's the chair of the European Commission, and that's his view. It doesn't look as if the backstop is going to be a real sticking point. And this, of course, is good news for Boris.
I don't want to exaggerate the progress that we are making, but we are making progress. And what we need to do, so people understand, we need to find a way whereby the UK can come out of the EU and really be able to do things differently, not remain under the control of the EU in terms of laws and trade policy, which is the problem with the current agreement. But we want to come out in such a way as to protect Ireland, make sure there isn't a border in a hard border of any kind in Northern Ireland, and make sure we protect the Good Friday peace process. Now, we think we can do that, and we think we can find a way forward. We think we can solve that problem. And I think we are making some progress. You heard Jean-Claude Juncker yesterday, I think it was, say that he doesn't have any emotional attachment to the backstop. Now, that is progress, because they weren't saying that a month ago. But let's see where we get. It's vital, whatever happens, that we prepare for no deal. and we will be ready. We will get ready for no deal on October the 31st. So you've got to do both things at once.
Well, Conservative MP Suella Braverman is one of those people who's been coming out and saying, well, she doesn't believe that May's Brexit negotiators, that they actually wanted to have Brexit to happen at all, that the people negotiating up until the end of the May government were just simply Remainers. And here she is with a couple of the other former ministers from those times.
Our entire negotiation has been fearful, conducted in a posture of supplication. The entire approach is suffused by a reluctance to deliver what the public wanted, which is us controlling our laws in our parliament, with all that that means.
And the result is we have ended up with what I would describe as a Remainers Brexit. And that's the problem, you know, that focusing on what they think matters about Brexit rather than what motivated 17.5 million people.
The straw that broke the camel's back for me was the final iteration of the Northern Irish backstop. And I considered it a betrayal because the clear and unequivocal promises by the government in manifestos and on the floor of the House and in speeches and in policy documents was that we would be able to leave the EU's customs union, leave the EU single market and bring an end to free movement of people. Under this deal, where we were to go ahead with it, the free movement directive would continue to apply because of the implementation period. We would still effectively be a member of the customs union and the single market. The jurisdiction of the ECJ would continue. Worse still, that would even continue beyond the end of the implementation period. It's the end date of which is now unclear in this agreement. I had a growing anxiety that I couldn't honestly state those positions without misleading. There comes a point when compromise becomes total surrender, and politicians at the head of that process have to bear the responsibility for it ultimately.
It's difficult to be too damning about the attitude that's been brought to the negotiation.
For me, that ultimately is a betrayal. To be offered in a treaty, taking the British people and our nation down a route which wasn't their expectations.
Well, that's you could call them a bunch of disgruntled ministers, actually, but they're saying, look, you know, actually the civil servants, it was Sir Humphrey just saying to us ministers that they were going to do it their way, and eventually variously, one by one, they resigned. But anyway, we've had a big change. Not the the rather shilly-shallying attitude of Jeremy Corbyn about which way he's going to go. The Liberal Democrat Party have been absolutely clear this week, and their leader, Joe Swinson, has made it clear that they are going to stop Brexit and they are going to revoke Article 50.
Whether we welcome those who want to build a better life in our country or shut the door on them, whether we ensure that every single child can go on to fulfil their dreams. The first task is clear. We must stop Brexit. And we are crystal clear. A Liberal Democrat majority government will revoke Article 50 on day one. Because there is no Brexit that will be good for our country.
That's Joe Swinson there. Finally, we've got a lot of clips to get through, and then we'll go back to our guests. Finally, big arrival at the Lib Dem conference was from the European Parliament was a very pro-Remain, obviously. From them is a guy called Guy Verhofstadt. He was there too. And he explained that actually you need to bandy together with your friends and your other countries nowadays. It's no point in being an independent country.
This European Union needs to be modernised, needs to be more effective. We cannot continue. We cannot continue, dear friends, with a Europe that is always acting too little and too late. In the world order of tomorrow, the world order of tomorrow is not a world order based on nation states or countries. It's a world order that is based on empires. China is not a nation. It's a civilization, Han. India, you know it better than I do, is not a nation. There are 2,000 nations in India. There are 20 different languages that are used there. There are four big religions at the same time. It is the biggest democracy worldwide. The US is also an empire, more than a nation. Maybe tomorrow they will speak there more Spanish than English. I don't know what will happen. And then finally, the Russian Federation. The world of tomorrow is a world of empires in which we, European and you, British, can only defend your interests, your way of life, by doing it together in a European framework and in the European Union. And those, dear friends, those who want to defend our standards of living, our social standards, our ecological standards, our labor standards, can only do that. They know it only in the framework of Europe and inside Europe, in the center, a Britain that takes its responsibilities and not is going out of this great project.
Well, that's Guy Verhofstadt there. He's a Belgian politician, served as the leader of the Alliance of Liberals and Democrats for Europe from 2009 to 2019, and MEP from Belgium since 2009, speaking at the Lib Dem conference. I think I'll ask you first, David Banks from Veterans for Britain. What do you make of this Lib Dem position now?
Well, it's changed, hasn't it, since the referendum. Some of their MPs after the referendum were even talking about respecting their constituents' wishes and respecting democracy. But no, they're now the illiberal anti-democrats, but we always knew that. You know, this whole choice, the choice that Joe Swinson has made, the choice that everybody in Britain faced 2016... because let's remember, it's done. We've had the argument, we've had the vote, but the question was about whether we stay in the EU or whether we leave. And that really boils down to whether we pursue an EU nationhood or whether we have a UK nationhood. And this man Verhofstadt made that very clear. You know, whether they might call it an empire rather than a nation, but it's about the same thing. It's the centralization of control. It's the creation of structures above our democracy in order to override our democracy, and that's why people were so upset with it.
Celia Phipps from Bedminster, Labour councillor, what do you make of those clips you've just heard, and particularly maybe the position of the Lib Dems now, which is as soon as they arrive in power, if they ever get there, we're leaving, and Brexit is going to never happen, according to them.
I think that's actually the flaw in her argument, the little word, when we've got a majority government, and I think that's not going to happen anytime soon, is it? So actually she can say we can do almost anything because she's never going to actually have to deliver it.
Well, we don't know that, though, do we? Because if they're making it a very, very clear position in a general election, it may be that people vote for them in their droves.
Well, we'll have to wait and see, won't we? But I think it's unlikely.
Martin, what do you make of those clips and the Lib Dems particularly?
Well, let's concentrate on the Lib Dems because obviously there's a whole spectrum of opinions there. There's all sorts of things being said. I mean, the Lib Dems, I think, it's a fairly cynical calculation that they can soak up the Remain voters by saying that they'll leave without a referendum. But I think that realistically that isn't going to happen. Ultimately, I think there will be a second referendum and then we will decide. And it's all very well saying we've had a referendum already. People who lived in the EU, British citizens who live in the EU, weren't allowed to vote. There's several million of them. They weren't allowed to vote in 2016.
Okay, so you don't like the referendum.
No, of course.
Can
I also make this point, Tony? I know we're on different sides of this, but let's
try. It's not the point, is it? If you have a vote, that is an instruction to
our public servants.
No,
it's not, Tony.
No, it isn't.
A referendum in the British system with our unwritten constitution... They've got a written constitution in Ireland because
look at the vote and then they can go, well, no, do we want to do something with this or not?
No, what happens is that in Britain, a referendum is in fact advisory. That's all it is. In
In Holland, they have referendums. In Switzerland, they have referendums. They're written into the constitution. There's all kinds of rules about them. And in actual fact, there are different rules in different countries.
That's because Parliament is sovereign.
That's because Parliament is sovereign in our system.
And so who's in charge, the people or Parliament?
Parliament elected by the people. Okay. And in actual fact, we had an election in 2017, if you remember, Theresa May didn't win, and she ended up being dependent on the DUP.
All we can do when
we could solve the Irish backstop problem.
All we can do.
We're talking about Brexit.
We were talking about Brexit. If you just stop interrupting, it's extremely difficult to focus and concentrate if every time I open your mouth you just interrupt me. Mm-hmm.
Same here.
It's really about whether or not the Parliament does what the people want it to do, or whether when the people vote a Parliament, then they can just do what they want, actually.
Well, you could say that, but in actual fact, the system we have in this country, the glorious system inherited from the ages, is that the Parliament decides. Referendums are advisory.
Anyway, whilst all this Brexit stuff is going on, there's a lot of other things that people need to be looking at, and one of them is the environment. We've had a big strike in Bristol today. In fact, all over the world, there's been people going on strike about other matters, nothing to do with Brexit, potentially. But this is the climate crisis. Now, Celia, I know this is something quite close to your heart. What's been going on and why is it so important?
What's been going on? Well, clearly we have an emergency because the planet is warming up, and we have got to, both individually and as citizens and as countries, we've got to do something about that. We've got to make sure that the Paris Agreement is actually delivered. That ain't no easy thing to do. And I thoroughly support the guys that have been out there today. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to. I deliver a service that I felt people needed me to be there, but there will be others who were in the same position. But I'm pleased and I'm glad that thousands and thousands of people were out there raising the argument.
What evidence is there that this is really a crisis? Because a lot of people say, well, actually, the weather's sort of getting a little bit warmer, but it's not necessarily a disaster.
Well, I think the evidence is quite clear, isn't it? It's I haven't got details of that with me, of course, but you can see by the increased risk of flooding, for example, the rate at which the Arctic and the Antarctic are beginning to water our country, even, you know, our planet even more, that there is a problem. Yes, we know we go through peaks and troughs over billions and billions of years, but that the rises we see now are in planet temperature are much more than they were.
Now, one of the things that's happening this weekend beginning is the Rugby World Cup in Japan. And I wonder where the environmentalists are. I mean, I'm going to be talking about Fukushima in the second hour. But where are the environmentalists here? Because you've got hundreds of thousands of people all flying to Japan, which is a country which doesn't really play rugby. And why on earth are the environmentalists not laying down in front of the planes on the runways of all the people who are going to Japan? I mean, it's an enormous movement of people across the world to go and see something that's in a country. It seems to me it's only being done for the money, you know, because there'll be lots of hotel bills to pay, lots of air flights to pay in a country halfway around the world. It's not very environmentally sustainable to hold a Rugby World Cup in a country that doesn't really play rugby.
But this is the dilemma, and in that we live on a whole planet and people go all around the world to all sorts of things, and they've got used to doing that in the last 10-20 years. I mean, families are spread around the world. Some of my family lives in New Zealand. That is the dilemma we face. It's great that Greta went by boat to America, but we won't all be able to do that kind of travel. The holiday industry is based on flying, and this is the kind of dilemma that we face. How do we change our lifestyle? How do we look at our own individual ways of living to make a difference? I have flown this year. I flew to Aberdeen, but I'm going to cut that down.
Why didn't you take the train?
because I only had a few days on holiday there and I wanted to make the most of it. Same
also,
as
also, you might have found it was like 10 times more expensive.
That's the other problem. You know, maybe we should make flights far more expensive. But then that makes it elitist again, like it used to be. So these are the things that have got to be thought through.
Well, I would have said, you know, don't hold the Rugby World Cup in somewhere where... I mean, this is just a basic thing, you know. If people can stay at their own home and go and watch the rugby, then that's great. But, you know, not on the other side of the world. Anyway, let's just ask David Banks from Veterans for Britain. What do you make of this climate protest today?
I think there's probably a lot of valid arguments behind the global warming concern. I used to work in the insurance industry, and we noticed that in the last 20 or so years, the number of hurricanes shot right up. I mean, it had become almost inevitable that there were going to be several damaging hurricanes crossing the Atlantic every year.
Okay, so how do we stop it? How do we actually, you know, do something?
Well, actually, before I mention that, one thing that's pertinent to your previous question is just the sort of commercialization of this whole sort of climate lobby, and the idea that children are taking a day off school, you know, and are being encouraged to do so, that's a political venture, and I have difficulty, you know, on a personal level, you know, separate to my group, from the idea that there is a sort of politicization of children in such a way that they are being encouraged to break the law. Is that the way to sort of encourage awareness?
Well, it's called civil disobedience. Martin, what do you make of that particular point David's mentioned there about, you know, sort of, it's almost, I mean, the news coverage is saying, oh, this is all led by the children, but it, you know, it's inevitably, it's going to be adults, at least many of them, who are behind this kind of protest, which involves children, including this whole Greta Thunberg business. There are, I mean, for example, her mother is some senior PR person in Scandinavia, and so that obviously is, you know, has had a bearing on whether she's been sort of put in front of the cameras.
Well, I think that, you know, there are lobbies on both sides, aren't there? I mean, there's the pro, the oil lobby is behind the scenes trying.
What about involvement of children?
Well, let's talk about involvement of children. I work with children. I think there are concerns about that. But don't forget, in the Scottish referendum on independence, 16-year-olds were allowed to vote. And in secondary schools, if you're going to have people voting at 16, and I'm in favour of voting at 16, you're going to have to start basically civic education classes from the age of 14 at minimum. And basically, I'm in favour of children being involved in politics, but it's got to be in a sensitive way. And but if they're going to be voting at the age of 16, they've got to be talking about the issues age 14. And I'm working at the moment with the 11-year-olds, and we are certainly discussing these issues in class as part of science lessons.
What do you say to the kids?
Well, I don't say it. I'm not actually doing the teaching.
You're listening.
The point is, anyway, that there's a lot of education going on
anyway,
around this issue.
Thanks to our guests, Labour councillor for Bedminster, that's Celia Phipps. This is and pro Brexit military pressure group Veterans for Britain, David Banks, will be staying with us for the second hour. Join me after the US owned Comcast News at 7 as we take our weekly look around the world.
Bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.